Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hello and welcome to the Dork Forest. I'm Jackie Cation, the host of the Dork Forest. You know my websites, I bet. JackieCation.com, DorkForest.com, TheDorkForest.com, FamilyPetAncestry.com, which I continue to pay for because it made me laugh. And I don't know how to get rid of it now. Does it still make me laugh? It kind of still does. The credits, let's do them. Mike Rickberg composed and sang the song in the beginning of the show. He sang with his wife, Sarah. He will sing his words to the Mexican Hat Dance after the program at the end of the show. Patrick Brady is going to fix this audio. And Vilmos just redid my website, JackieCation.com. And speaking of which, the Amazon banner, which is under the Support the Show link on the – when you go to JackieCation.com, you click Support the Show, and you can either donate. Regular donation applies. If you like the show, please do donate. And there is also a banner or a portal into Amazon, and it is the Amazon banner, where you just order from Amazon, and the Dork Forest gets a kickback. Well, I was told by a fan that it was kind of a pain. Are other people finding it a pain to use the Amazon banner? And email me if so. And I don't know what Vilmos can do about it, but we can look into it. Jackie@JackieCation.com. Those are the two things you can do on JackieCation.com. DorkForest.com should have the teaser clip. It'll have the notes with the credits. It'll have the episode that you can listen to, links to download it, links to iTunes, links to the store. The store is back at JackieCation.com, where you can get Dork Forest t-shirts or Ranger of the Dork Forest t-shirt or Spooky Reading Girl t-shirts, which is my stand-up t-shirt. You can also see where I'm doing stand-up this week on my schedule. This week, I'm actually going to a Toledo, Ohio comedy festival on Friday, and then the All Jane Comedy Festival in Portland on Saturday and Sunday, where I'm going to do a lot of comedy, obviously. And then in Portland, I'm going to do a live Dork Forest. So live Dork Forests are kept on the Bandcamp page. Those are $2 a piece because they cost me some money to do them. And so I pass that non-savings on to you. Feel free. There's also a bunch of free stuff. What is it? I think it's thedorkforest.bandcamp.com. Anyway, other than that, come and see me do comedy, and let's get into the show. Hey, it's Jackie Cation. I'm back in my living room here in Van Nuys. It's pretty exciting. And I'm here with a guy that interviewed me for his podcast. It's Stuart Goldsmith. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's great to be
here. And it's called Comedians Comedian.
That's right.
And comedians plural, comedian. Yep. .com is the website for the podcast, but it's on iTunes and
yeah,
normal
absolutely.
Places
yes.
to get it. And it's at ComComPod on Twitter.
That's
and
true.
Stuart, you are it's such a great podcast
Thank
about
you.
Comedy because of the amount of research that you're willing to do.
I tell people
this all the time. I'm like, you listen to all of my albums.
Yeah.
I don't want to.
The market, I think, for comedy interview shows is, as we know, oversubscribed. And so anything you can do to make yourself stand out is important. You have
right.
a brilliant angle. I have what
the
I try and do
forest, yes.
is I try to – I have two things that separate me. One is the point of the show is it's like a forensic examination of how people write their material. And
Man.
Then it becomes a forensic examination of whether or not they're happy and whether the sacrifices they made worked out for them. It gets very
psychological.
Was it
all worth it? Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Was it all
that.
Worth it? One of my favorite questions is, mm-hmm. what does it cost?
Yeah.
And was that worth it?
I remember that.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one of the angles. But then also, because there are other people, you know, nipping at my heels in that kind of territory mm-hmm. as well, or people at whose heels I am nipping.
Yeah.
The other thing I try to do is huge amounts of research, because the most exciting moments for me are when I can challenge someone on their preconceptions of themselves.
Right.
And not for the sake of an argument, but for the sake of saying, well, you say that, but I've always thought this. And you
and
said
what do
in
you
2008,
think?
With this bit of material, that joke seems to come from this place or that place.
Right.
So I really over-prepare and get very tense.
It's kind of beautiful because it gives you sort of – or gave me, the comedian really gave me an overview of my whole act. You know, because you had listened to all of it in
yes.
a row. And so it was – and so nice work is what I guess
yeah,
I said.
Yeah, thanks. Well, thank you. I remember describing you as you're the champion of the sort of beleaguered nerds. Now, the champion of the outsiders.
Sure. Yeah. I'm willing to go to bat. I'll go to bat for a dork. Safe space dorks for us. Andy, my husband, very excited about your dorkdom.
Oh, yeah.
He's a little disappointed. He's teaching Game Design 101 over at this local sort of tech school or trade school. And he was like, you guys are going to talk about game mechanics. Because he liked the idea that you wanted to talk about story in game.
Yes.
And then your favorite, one of your favorite board games, I've played it once, that the zombie one.
Dead of Winter.
Dead of Winter.
Oh, my God.
Right. So what – I've only played it once. I like the idea of that story mechanic. But let's explain, first of all, what you like about – because you genuinely – you want to play a game that has a good story to it. Is that what it
is? Well, it's a number of things, really. I don't exclusively play story-driven games, but I suppose – and there's probably, and Andy will know, I'm sure there's probably better terms for these, there's more accurate terminology. But what I say when I mean game mechanics is – just the way, you know, the first time you played something like Pandemic, where you went, it's all of us versus the game.
Yes.
That throws such a spanner in the works of what you expect from a game.
Yes.
That initially my eyes lit up. I was like, oh my God, that's like a whole new way of doing it. Imagine if it was all of you versus Monopoly, which it should be.
Which it is in real life.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Jesus.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting mechanic or a mechanism. That's like a really good, like that was a very evocative kind of, oh my God. And so there are others, like there's a game called Spyfall where you're trying, that's a whole different thing.
Is that
where,
a James Bond one or no?
It's not linked to James Bond.
Okay.
It's a loosely sort of spy-based game.
It's just a spy game.
But that's a game whereby one of you is a spy and the others don't know, and it's randomly determined by cards. Someone gets a spy card. Everyone else that round gets an identical card of a location.
Okay.
Such as like we're all at the circus.
Right.
And then without revealing whether you're the spy or not, everyone has to ask each other questions. Like, so, how long have you been working here? And you're trying to, the spy, when he asks those questions, is trying to give the impression he knows what the place is, same as everyone, and is passing the time of day.
Know.
And the other people are trying to catch out the spy, and the spy is trying not to be caught out. So you might, if the thing is the circus, you might kind of go, so how did you get here? And if someone knows it's the circus, they might go, well, I was born into it. And if if the spy manages to say something like that or take a risk, then they might get away with it for that round.
Oh, right.
And the spy wins by guessing. He goes, it's the circus. Because if you just go, so have you met the lion tamer?
Right.
It's a dead giveaway. So it's a very finely balanced.
Oh, so you have to sort of, you want to answer the questions in sort of a cryptic manner so you don't give it away.
Exactly.
You don't say, well, I ran away to join it.
Yeah, because if you said that, then the spy could be sitting at the table and go, the spy might not be the questioner or the questionee that round. They might go, oh, it's clearly the circus. I was the spy. I win.
Spyfall the one where is it just the one round, kind of like apples to apples?
I haven't played that one. I've heard of it.
Okay.
I've not played that. But there are, I think there's something like 30 or something, 35 individual Ziploc bags with seven identical cards and a spy card in each one.
Okay.
So each time you play it, it's completely, you randomly generate which location, and there's a ton of locations.
And there's but you're playing the one location and...
Yeah, per round. You might go, this round is, I think there's a timer. It's 8 minutes tops per round.
And then you talk amongst yourselves for 8 minutes.
Yeah.
And the spy is trying to figure out, and everyone else is trying not to give it away.
Exactly.
But let everybody know. And what if they figure out who the spy is before the spy?
You can accuse the spy at any time, but obviously if you accuse the wrong person, then the spy wins that round.
Oh, the spy wins the round.
So there's only one accusation.
And when you're using the word round, is that a British thing? Where is that the whole game?
Oh, no. Well, if you might say, okay, let's play five rounds and
tot up the
points afterwards.
Oh, so you pick five little baggies.
Five baggies, exactly.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah, and in each round, a different person will be the spy.
Fair enough.
It could be the same person.
Yes. Oh,
by which time, round
like
four,
they'd
be going,
game.
It's me again. Can we redeal? Because I don't want to be the spy. And then you get dealt the spy again, and you keep your mouth shut. But none of this is about Dead of Winter, but I'm just trying to illustrate when you come across something that has an interesting approach to the whole idea of a game. It's like, I don't know if you've seen Stranger Things on Netflix, but you know, they've got this D&D type, quest type board. And then they realize, without giving too much away, that there is a thing by which they wipe the pieces off the board, turn it upside down, and go, it's like this. Anything like that has a frisson for me that I go, I haven't even considered it like this.
Right,
it's
right.
So exciting. So the basic setup of Dead of Winter, for those that don't know, is you have Now, I've managed to get the explanation of the rules down to 15 minutes, and that is going at a lick. So I I'll simplify even further. That would be if we were playing, I could get you
nice
match ready in 15. I really like explaining things. But you have a number of locations, one of which is the colony where your post-apocalyptic survivors live. It's in winter.
It's like a compound.
It's a compound. Yeah. And it's the zombie apocalypse has happened. It's like you come in much the same way as the very beginning of Walking Dead. He wakes up, it's already going on. So there's six locations, like a gas station, police station, school, library, and so on.
And that's the board. The board has got these different locations.
Yes. And then there are something like 30 playable characters, and you each start with two. You randomly generate with cards.
Yep.
They are interesting characters with interesting names, brilliantly drawn in such a way as you go, oh, this one, you never go, this one's clearly a good guy. You go, oh, is he heroic or is he sort of malevolent looking?
Yeah, the art is kind of ambiguous. Yeah.
Very deliberately ambiguous, I think. So that you go, oh, this kid, he's like a student, but is he the kind of student that'll kind of race hot rods and knife you?
Yeah.
Or is he the sort of student who's like just looks a bit tough but actually a good guy? Each of them have two characteristics, their ability to search for things and their ability to fight things.
Right.
And each of them also has one special ability, which might be linked to a place. The student's ability, I think, is the strongest in the game, which is to mimic the ability of whoever he's with.
Oh, okay.
But someone might say, when this character is in the library, because they grew up in the library, they're the bookworm type character, they're able to search twice as efficiently. That sort of thing.
Yeah, that kind of random.
The game is trying to kill you in every possible way. You start off, there's a variety of different missions of killing a certain number of zombies, trying to get a certain number of...
You've got to go get supplies, if I remember
correctly.
You have
to get supplies. So there are different types of supplies. There's junk, there's fuel, food, and medicine.
Okay.
And those can all be used for different things. It's too numerous to get into. But you find them. There's a deck of cards on each of the six locations.
Yeah.
Not in the compound, not in the colony. So you have to go somewhere, brave the zombies there. Even traveling, you have to roll there's lots of D6 for, like, you spend D6. You start off with three, you roll them, you go, okay, I can do three things this turn.
Oh, right.
If you...
You get three... You get a six-sided die for each action you can do, kind of?
You get a three-sided die for each person that you control, which is two to begin with, unless anyone dies. Or you can easily meet many other people along the way. Followers, they join your party, you get a dice for them, and you might find yourself... You might be playing a game where two players are controlling two people each, and one player is controlling six people.
Okay.
And has much more...
Oh, interesting.
More
yeah.
So there is an advantage to finding other people along the way, but it's also a disadvantage, because every round you have to feed everybody, and you have to clear the waste out of the compound, and if that overflows, morale goes down. And the game is just trying to kill you in every possible way. Every time you move from the colony to a location or back or location to a location, you have to roll a 20-sided dice, and there is a possibility that you will be injured or frostbitten. And there is one symbol of a tooth, like a molar, floating. And if you roll that, you're immediately dead, and there's no way to stop it.
Oh, you just die.
If you roll the tooth icon on that one, you've got a 1 in 20 chance, you're immediately dead. You've got no way to stop it. There's no comebacks. And if that character is in a room with other characters, there is a bite effect where it chains, and you get bitten, you immediately bite the person next to you. They have to roll the dice.
Oh, my God.
So it's just terrifying. Now, there are two other things that make the game what it is. Like, that's a great idea. It's enjoyable. I'd enjoy playing that. Certainly.
Right.
One of the mechanisms of the game is that everyone has, like, you all have a kind of a group super objective.
Okay.
Which is kill 20 zombies before time runs out. There's a marker, you know, different days.
Oh, does the objective, can it change?
That's an interesting question. No, there's one immutable.
There's usually it's the group project.
It's sort the group
like,
project.
Sort of like pandemic, cure these things.
Yeah, absolutely.
And be
right.
done. Okay.
Yes. But within that, then everyone has a secret personal objective.
Oh, that's right.
So you can win the game whilst losing your personal objective. What you really want to do is win both.
Right.
Your personal objective might be something like finish the game with the most number of followers.
Okay.
Or finish the game with the most amount of food cards in your hand concealed from the rest of the group. And in order to achieve that, when you as a team are working like, okay, this round we have to get a certain amount of food, otherwise this terrible thing happens, you might know that you've got three food cards in your hand and you go, I just don't have any food. And people may get suspicious. But that's okay because you're all working together.
Right.
Not necessarily, because one of these secret mission cards may or may not be a traitor card, whereby your secret objective is to make sure that you as a team lose the game.
Weird.
So someone might
is
be a traitor.
Is that an expansion set? Or is
no,
that
no, no,
the original?
No, comes with the game.
Okay.
Someone might be the traitor, or they might not. Because the way you do it, it's very simple. If there's five players, say, I think you can do five, you get two secret mission cards per player. So that's 10 of those.
Okay.
And to those 10, you add one traitor card. You shuffle them all together and everyone picks one.
Okay.
So you don't know whether there even is a traitor.
Right.
So it fosters this incredible, this is what I mean about the narrative.
Yeah, yeah.
This sense whereby, Jackie's hoarding food. Is that?
Are you hoarding food?
Let's start keeping an eye on the moves Jackie's making and let's not let her know that we've noticed that.
Okay.
At the same time, someone might be going, I think Jackie's hoarding food because they're the traitor and they're secretly hoarding medicine and they want to throw everyone off. Or someone, neither of those things might be happening and everyone's working together. And when you accuse someone, are you sure you're not the traitor? Man, I wouldn't do that to you. And they genuinely wouldn't.
We're in this together.
But just like in the actual zombie apocalypse, what have we learned from The Walking Dead is it's not the zombies you have to fear, it's each other.
Right, right.
So this wonderful sense. So that's one mechanism. And the other one, which I think is, I believe it's a Crossroads thing. This is a Crossroads game. That's their some sort of branding strand for the game. Which is a brilliant way of keeping people engaged when they've just had their go. Because we all know what that's like in any board game. You complete your go and you go, I was concentrating on that.
Yeah.
I'm done. In this one.
And you check your phone.
Exactly right. So in this game, there is a huge stack of yellow Crossroad cards. And every time someone finishes their go, they conclude their turn, the next person goes and that person takes a yellow Crossroads card, which has a set of conditions in italics at the top of the card. It's full of text.
Okay.
And it will say something like, if such and such a character is in play during this game, or if the player who's playing searches the library this go, read the following conditions.
Okay.
So you're looking at it thinking, could this happen? Is that person still in play? Is that person dead?
This is still the vampire, the zombie game.
Yes, yes.
I forgot about that crosswords. So when you're done with
it's
your turn.
It's very easy to forget to use them in the game because they're, because you're used to doing it. But your last move in your turn is to go, okay, your go and pick up a Crossroads card.
That's right.
Because what that means then is there are narrative elements which intrude into the game. And there's a huge number of these cards.
Yeah.
And because you only need to read the italics, we made a sort of pact, me and my brother, when we first got the game, we're not going to read any further than that. So that if such and such a character isn't in play at the moment, we don't know what that
you
card
don't know
refers
what's going
to
happen.
It can come up later on.
Yeah.
So one of the most exciting ones is Daft, but there's a little dog called Sparky. Everyone's a human apart from one character is a dog called Sparky, the stunt dog. Yeah, fun little guy. And and if Sparky is in play on a particular card, one of his cards, he may have several, I'm not used up all of them, I don't think, just yet, is that he might get equipped with a gun. So he's got like a kind of mouth off. Someone finds a workshop and they go, hey, come here, Sparky. You know, so, and the other thing is you really want the person with the Crossroads card, if the conditions are met, they go, okay, stop. I think this has happened. And you then want them to read it out with as much kind of portent and performance as possible.
Play it. Play it up.
And it's designed to help you do that. It's, you know, it's this, you know, quote marks around certain things. You wait and you notice what is that? Oh, you know, your days are numbered, but then, and then there's a choice at the end. So it might say all players who are currently in the colony with Sparky have to decide whether or not they think he's rabid.
Right.
Or what, you know, if the student is in play, there's a fantastic character. Arguably slightly racially insensitive. I think he's one of the only Asian characters in the game, and he's called Mike Cho, and his occupation is ninja.
Ninja. Well, the thing is, first of all, there are no people of color in the damn board games usually, right?
Yes.
There's usually, it lends itself to so many white guys.
Yeah.
And then they
there are loads of women.
They added a bunch of, they've added recently, people are like, we're going to do women. We're going to try to do it.
Yes.
And now the fact that they're adding, they could give them, but any job that you could go and go, oh, he's a computer operator, is he?
Yeah.
Oh, is he driving? Because there's a bunch of hack comics who do a bunch of stuff about Asian drivers, and you're like, we're all over, to some extent you're overthinking it. If it were you know, he owns a Chinese restaurant, well, that might be a little on the nose, buddy.
Yeah.
And so Ninja might be a little on the nose, but who cares?
Another Asian character as well. There's certainly at least one black character. There's a guy who's a park ranger. He's a good solid character.
Anybody handicapped?
Given
anybody deaf?
There is
going to happen.
I don't know about anyone deaf. There is one character who is called what's his name? Plum, something Plum, and
Colonel Plum.
He's a mall Santa is his job, and he's an alcoholic. And his special power is remove him from the game at any time to increase morale by one because he's such a drag to have around. But like, if you've only got two characters, you don't want to get rid of him. But
because every character gives you extra die.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Got it.
So, I mean, you're absolutely right. Given the number of characters there are, there could be way more non-white characters. And it's a little bit like when, have you seen the Lego movie?
Yeah.
So a friend of mine pointed out to me that the Lego movie is not very feminist. There are only three female characters. One of them is a hysterical uni kitty. One of them is the wild side, whatever her name is, who does everything her boyfriend tells her. And the other one is the little girl at the end who ruins it all.
Right. Well, but the thing is Wild Child or whatever her, and because I did love that movie and I saw it twice, but I can't remember. I think her name ended up being like Samantha or something. Remember she tells her real name at the end of it?
Yes.
It's, there was a little bit of disappointment in when people saw it. They were like, well, why isn't she the chosen one?
Yeah.
Because she can do everything already. She's already a master builder.
Yes.
Why does it have to be Larry?
Yes.
You know? And
what particularly rankled was it's Lego. There doesn't need to be any gender in Lego. There doesn't need to be any sexism.
Right.
You could easily have half of those characters be female. Just do it. And what it speaks to is that the people making it didn't think about it.
No.
They just didn't think about it. And that's the worst. That's when you spot it in your own life. When someone goes, oh, but you did that, you know, with podcast guests, for example.
Right.
And someone goes, oh, a lot of white guys there. And you go, oh, Jesus, there are, because I've just been getting my friends.
And I mostly
most of
know
my friends are
white
guys.
Yeah. It's in stand-up comedy, it's a huge thing where you'll talk to somebody who, like black guy comics that I know, happen to know more black guy comics.
Yeah.
And I happen to know more women comics.
Yep.
And it's what it is. And so you have to make an effort to get out of your own head. And the only time that we all do it is when somebody's famous.
Yeah.
We're like, no, I'm going to get that guy, even though he is nothing like me, but he's famous and it's going
to
help.
Yes. Because he's on my radar. And if you aren't paying attention to your radar, it's very easy to just go.
Right. So you have to be aware. So when people do make these games, it's good that people are aware that you've got to look around you.
Absolutely.
It's somebody was talking about how, why somebody on Facebook, that's where it all happens, you guys. I was talking about if you're a white guy booking a show, don't make sure that you add women and people of color. How about you add a white guy?
Yeah.
Just get everybody else and then add
a
white guy.
Stop treating women and people of color as spec acts.
Right.
Who are like a genre in their own right. And let's have three white guys and one woman. We've done our job. You haven't done your job.
How about just one white guy and you get everybody else to whatever. Even though, you know, and I'm sympathetic to everybody who does stand-up comedy because it's hard for everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, as a white guy, nobody's handing you 20s under the table.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like that from afar. That's what it looks like, but it's hard. It's a hard career.
Something came up recently. I came to a realization recently that was quite apposite, I think. I was told by an industry professional that the reason you can't get on this show is just, you know, this, you know, if you were, it was a words tantamount to, if you were black, if you were minority ethnic, could get on this TV show. And obviously that to me, my most immediate reaction is, oh God, it's unfair.
Yeah.
And then I suddenly thought, how many white guys have they said that to? It's not like I'm the only white guy and they're going, well, we're going to have to tell Stu that because he's not black. They must have said that to 100 white guys.
Right.
So it's not like if there was no black person available to fill that slot, it would be me. It would be one of the other 99 white guys in the pack.
Right.
So, but you don't think about that. No one ever makes that explicit. You have to have your eyes open and go, oh, yeah. The fact that I'm not being held back from that job because I'm not black or minority ethnic.
No.
I'm just being held back from that job because there is only one job and there's an awful lot of people that want to do it.
And when you watch the show, it's still going to be four white guys.
Mm-hmm.
And you're...
that is sadly true. Yes, absolutely.
Well, it's not like... You're the 99th white guy they can't book.
That's exactly the point I was
you're
trying
like,
to make.
That's
perfectly put. Yes.
So, but it's... It
but you just hear, oh, you can't book me because I'm white.
Right.
And you're like, no, you're the 99th white guy.
We picked the first four.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then there was another 100.
Yep.
And I'm very sorry to tell you.
That is 100% right. And I wish more people would recognize that because that, I mean, I say that from having the point of view of someone who recently realized
it.
And now really wants everyone else to know.
Well, but it's true though, because you're in the water that you're in, you know, you're swimming in the water that you're in. So you're not really aware of what that water is like. You know, you're used to things being a certain way. Like there's being a woman. I was recently, about a year ago, reminded, about, one of these horrible shootings, here in Santa Barbara. And this guy was a nutbag and he was sick of women not paying attention to him.
Yes.
So he decided to kill people. Hey, don't do that. Just keep trying. It'll be fine. Anyway, and reintroduce yourself to your hand. So, there's alternatives. But I was reminded that, you know, cause I don't ever think of myself as a woman. I am a woman and I enjoy whatever, but I don't think about the things that I do defensively as a woman because I'm a woman. I just do them. You know, if it's late, I try to get someone to walk me to my car. If I'm walking back to the hotel and I see a pile of drunk people, I get on the other side of the street because I don't want a confrontation. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to win. And, you know, I do the things and it's not anything I'm doing consciously. It's just, since I've been 13, you learn how to live a little defensively. You know, it's not crazy. I'm not carrying a knife.
You have a bow and arrow, Jackie.
I do. Right there. There's my bow and arrow. And the quiver. And my steampunk fake gun. Super fun. Anyway, so in games, there is, I think, an obligation to look around.
There is a huge opportunity to do that. An opportunity and an obligation. I think you're right. And I think because, I mean, now board games cafes are springing up everywhere, which is lovely. Yeah. And there's a lot of white men sitting in board games cafes. And it's lovely to see girls in board games cafes, women.
Yeah.
And it's lovely to see non-white people. But it would be really, maybe that would happen more if the games that were being designed didn't have token people of color and token women.
Or you had to just speculate and turn Han Solo into a girl. Or into a black guy. And so it's whatever it is, but it is good. And there is a lot of work, I think, because, you know, Andy makes games. And so he spends a fair amount of time talking to people about inclusion and trying to make sure that it isn't weird and just make sure that everybody wants to play, mostly because he wants to play games with everyone all the time.
Yep. And I think it's probably true to say, and this is a sweeping generalization, but I would imagine most game designers are white men. And so when they create a hero, a hero character for any player to pour themselves into, then of course their natural thought would be, well, it's a white guy.
Yeah.
Because that's what I am and that's who I'll relate to. And they worry, I guess, or we worry that if the lead character in the game was a black girl, then 90% of the people who are going to play that game won't play that game because they'll have some difficulty.
But sell it. Sell it to the black women of the world who wish to play games.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But I think as well as that, sell it to people, just trust people to get over themselves enough that it's a good enough game, it's enjoyable, and
just
it doesn't matter.
Just do the game. Yeah, it's so true. You know, that, I digress again into comedy just because I don't ever want to think that the audience isn't going to get stuff because the audience is smarter than you think.
Yep.
If you play to the smartest people in the room, it's like when you play any game. Like if you were to play basketball with somebody, if you play basketball with someone who's better than you, your game gets better.
Yes.
So,
yeah. Right.
So if you make the game. I mean, but what you said is so important. Just make the game fun and then everyone will want to play it. And then don't worry about who the character, but your love of the game were in the characters, you know, like Pandemic has those five characters and then it has an expansion set.
Yes. And I believe, I'm sure I read this recently. Maybe this is why it's in my head, but I believe the box of Pandemic, the new edition, the lead figure is a scientist and she happens to be a woman.
Oh, there you go.
Which is great.
Which is right. And I got Pandemic Legacy for Christmas.
Oh, I've heard about that. I haven't played it.
I've only got to play two games.
I love the concept of the legacy thing. My friends are playing Risk Legacy. So this is a game where it's, you play a certain number of games, the board changes, elements are destroyed and removed and permanently altered as the campaign goes on. I mean, I find that so exciting.
It's one whole campaign and you could play the game like 15 times and then, and the legacy theme of games goes for different publishers.
I see. Okay.
Because Risk is made by different people that make Pandemic.
Oh, that's great. It's like a crossover because all the game developers went, this idea is so objectively good, we should all do it.
Yes.
That's good. So no one owns copyright to Legacy.
I think it's a guy. A guy has it, but he works for different companies.
I would love to find out that he said, no, I'm not going to patent this. Yeah. I want to give it to the world. Like Cards Against Humanity doing that. Oh, just download the game. You know?
Yes, yes. Did you, and then Cards Against Humanity, which I, see, apples to apples. Have you played Cards Against Humanity?
Yes, I have, yeah.
Okay, so apples to apples is essentially the idea of Cards Against Humanity. Okay. But it's, there's a green card in the middle. It's a you have a handful of nouns, proper nouns, regular nouns, all the nouns. In the middle, a descriptive word. The descriptive word can be fuzzy. And in your hand, everyone secretly puts down a card from their hand into the middle. And then the one person is in charge of the middle card, and they get to pick, like Cards Against Humanity, which one's funniest, which one's most literal.
Oh, lovely. Well, okay.
Whatever their deal is. So if fuzzy is in the middle, you secretly put down Moses or Fuzz.
Yep.
Those are both nouns. And those are both in the deck. So that is a great game. There's no story to it. Uh-huh. There's no story, like Cards Against Humanity doesn't have a story. But there's a third game that I believe I've talked about at length, and in my act I'm talking about it because it's my current favorite party game. Oh, it's kind of like Cards Against Humanity, and it's called Bring Your Own Book.
Oh, I love the sound of this. Go on.
It is the most introverted party game of your life.
Okay.
So we've played it twice so far, and I need to play it again. But what you do is like we're set up in a card table in my living room, right? Bring Your Own Book has a stack of like green cards. It has a stack of middle cards. Someone is in charge of the middle card. They pick it. They read. There's two different choices of what you can read. You read it. What is a codicil on a contract that is super fine print on a contract?
Okay.
And everyone has picked a book. Either they are a giant nerd and brought a book, in they have an emergency book on their person at all times, which I often do.
Mm-hmm.
Or we have done this thing where everybody picks a book in the house that they're playing the card in.
Okay.
So our living room has many respectable books.
Very much so.
And these are the books that we are willing to tell people that we read. Secret books, they're in the other rooms, or whatever, right? So everybody picked different books. There's classics, there's Harry Potter, there's Lord of the Rings. Everybody picked all the different things. And you say, okay, codicil, it could be that. Or little known James Bond tattoo. That was another one.
Okay.
And you have, everybody starts looking in their books for something that might fulfill that.
Okay.
That might be funny, that might be interesting.
I see. So it's a way of playing apples to apples or Cards Against Humanity with books.
With books.
I understand.
And then someone says, oh, I got one. And then there's a timer with a minute. Everybody else has another minute to pick. And then you read it. And so there's no secret to it.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone just reads it. And then the person who's in charge of the middle card picks.
Oh, great.
And
okay.
But here's the interesting thing is when you win two of the middle cards, you pass your book to the left.
Okay.
So the books rotate.
Nice.
You don't ever get your own, the same book all the time. And we played it here, and we played it at a barbecue, and the books that the people who had the barbecue were all self-help books and gardening books.
Oh.
So it was hilarious.
Oh my God.
And
yeah,
so
that
the
would
game
work.
Changes depending what house, what building you're in.
That's very
what
good.
Books are sitting
well,
around.
Well, that, to me, that sort of reminds me of what I was going to say next, which is that we talk about the narrative of games. And
yeah.
While those games might not have an overt narrative in the sense of a story, they do, of course, foster the narrative of the game itself and the way that people within one experience of maybe an hour and a half playing a game with a group of people, people become versions almost like in the same way, again, with comedians, there's your real self and your comic, your onstage persona. People will grow their own personalities within the game.
And you'll learn things? Or?
Well, yes. Or I suppose just in terms of the story of this particular game. Like one example from Dead of Winter, there is the narrative of the game, which is that I played a fabulous two-player round of the game with my brother, and we played for nearly 2 hours. And at the very end, we were one step away from completing the quest and both winning. And it got to my final move, and I said, "This is my last dice that I'm spending. I'm going to shoot Olivia." And the look on his face was wonderful because I had been the traitor all along and I had worked for the team. And at the very end, I turned around and I shot the doctor with a sniper rifle at point-blank range. And so that's the narrative of the game is that Olivia died, but almost the meta narrative of the game is I betrayed my brother.
Yes.
So in that way, if you play a game like, for example, Werewolf, have you played Werewolf?
Yes.
Oh, it's a
yes.
wonderful, wonderful game. And, you know, just for the sake of the listener, you are in any group, I think minimum 8 people. and two people are werewolves. Everyone else is a villager. This is the most basic version of the game. No cards required. You secretly establish that two of you are werewolves. Mm-hmm. You can communicate each other. It's night every so often. Everyone closes their eyes. The werewolves can look at each other, pick a person to murder. And the game is just arguing.
Right.
The game is just going, I mean, the favorite thing that comes up when we play it is someone will say, well, I don't know. I think I felt Jackie's arm move next to mine. She might have been miming something. And then someone will immediately say to that person, sounds like werewolf chat to me. You know, and it's just blaming people.
Right.
I've said this for some reason, there's been in my mind over the weekend, I've said this to a couple of people socially, but in all honesty, whenever I play werewolf with my friends, I am such a good liar. I'm genuinely a nice person. I'm empathic, and I know what's important to people, and I pervert that. I exploit that, and I am a phenomenal liar. So it is now a house rule that whenever we play werewolf with my friends, you always execute Stew first. Because it's just heartbreaking. It's better.
You might as well.
It's better to kill an innocent man than it is to risk the heartbreak of Stu getting away with it again.
An innocent man. Oh my God, that's hilarious.
So in that example, there is the narrative of the game of who's a villager, who's a villager, and then there is the meta narrative of, we've got to kill Stu first. And, you know, one of the reasons Werewolf is so successful is because that game is 90% meta-narrative.
Right.
And so I think even when you're playing Monopoly, when you're playing Snap, when you're playing Apples to Apples or Cards Against Humanity.
Sure.
Yeah, there's the narrative of the people in the room and how they relate to one another and betray each other and people who are, this is one of the things I love about board games. It draws people out of themselves. It doesn't just benefit, you know, we're both outgoing, socializing, extroverted people. And it's great to see someone introverted step out of themselves. It's great to see someone extroverted draw back and be quiet and pay attention. And I just love that aspect of it.
That's fascinating. Yeah. When I visit my brother in Milwaukee, he's got two sons and we've always brought board games and played board games. And these two boys, they're brothers and they're so competitive. They're just like constantly backstabbing each other. And you're like, can we just play the game? I mean, I know you want to win, but, and they both play their mother against each other. They're like, no, support me. And it's this weird, I get super anxious sometimes in those games where it becomes hyper competitive. Like, cause there's Mafia, which is like werewolf, where you're a mob person. And then there's a game called Bang, which is an actual board game, a card game where, two people are outlaws, four people are deputies, one person's the sheriff. I mean, like, it gets super complex all the different, and the four outlaws have one project, the four deputies have one project, the sheriff has one project, the outlaws have a project, and the renegades, whatever, and then there's something called Cash and Guns.
Yes, I've never played it. I'm really excited about playing it. I love the idea of that.
Andy calls it has a really good toy value because Dead of Winter is really good toy value in the way that the art is so good.
Yes.
And you get these characters in stands that you can stare at and it looks really
absolutely
cool.
And if you go down to eye level on the board and kind of peer through and you can always do a panning shot and obviously in the background you're playing the Romero soundtracks on your speaker. You know, you've got proper music to play it with.
Right.
My brother play a game called Netrunner. I can't really play it with him anymore because he's too good.
What is it? Is it game or a video?
Let me do. I'll try and condense this because we can talk about that all day.
Yeah.
The link was that it's set in the future. It's a hacking game. Computer hacking.
Oh wow.
And so we always make sure to. We've got playlists on SoundCloud of electronic music that feels particularly. The Blade Runner soundtrack is fantastic.
Okay.
Asymmetrical card game. Most card games are symmetrical. Everyone has access to the same cards. This one is asymmetrical. One of us plays a hacker, one of us plays a corporation. And my job as a corporation, I have an entirely different pack of cards to you, and they are all things I could tell you all the minutiae.
Is it a two-person game?
It's only two people. It can only ever be two people.
Netrunner.
Oh, you're gonna
and it's
love
a card game.
Card game. So I'm the corporation, and my job is to take my deck of cards and install my cards into servers and protect those servers with something called ICE, which is like intrusion countermeasures. You know, it's kind of defensive stuff. So I'll put a card down, face down, and over the game I will build up more and more face down cards in front of it to prevent you getting to it.
Okay.
You will build a rig. So you're doing something that looks similar.
Right.
But what you're doing is you're building a computer
To get past it.
Exactly. You have a computer and you are adding programs and software, interesting different cards. Oh, great. I can install that one for a certain amount of credits.
This sounds amazing.
Oh my God, you're going to love it. And so you build up your computer until such time as you're able to break through my countermeasures, but at the same time, my countermeasures are increasing.
Right.
So I win the game by either advancing my agendas, the things in the servers.
Right.
I put tokens on them when they're still face down, and when I have enough tokens, depending on the card, I can turn it over and go, great, that's some points that I've scored.
Right.
You score points by breaking through the countermeasures and snatching away my agenda before it's scored on my side. I can also win by killing you, because
kill that virus.
But I can also kill you, the person, because some of your cards require you to be physically jacked in your Johnny Mnemonic style. You've got cables coming out of your head.
Oh my God.
You've got a certain number of, there's three types of damage you can suffer, and one of them is called, I think there's net damage, something else damage, and then meat damage. And meat damage is wonderful because you can only ever have five cards in your hand. There are infinite variations, but basically you can have five cards in your hand. And if I do you meat damage, then it reduces the number of cards in your hand as you become less able to do your job frying your brain from afar. And when you lose all of your cards, that's you dead.
Wow.
So it's going to change your life. And the thing is, it's collectible, and they keep releasing expansion packs called data packs.
All right.
But it's not something like Magic. It's not Magic the Gathering because it's a collectible card game. So everyone has access to the same cards. The cards themselves.
Oh, just buy decks.
You buy decks. They're
you're
not random.
Getting random.
You're not getting random ones. And as a result, there's no economy of going, well, if I spend $1,000, I can get this. It's the best card that always wins.
Yeah. As much as I like Magic, that is such a capitalistic kind of way.
It's hugely unattractive to me. It makes me not interested in the game at all.
I like playing it, but I don't have anything to prove.
Sure.
You know, think I got, I just bought a couple of the new set and I got this Platinum Angel.
Okay.
And the Platinum Angel it's one of these cards that means that nobody can win. If I can get it in my deck, right?
Yep.
If I can play it, I win.
Yeah,
either I win or nobody wins.
Yeah.
That's what's going to happen. And
emblazoned in a tattoo across the front of the Platinum Angel. Either I win or nobody wins.
But sew that on a pillow.
But coming back to narrative, one of the wonderful things about Netrunner, besides how finely balanced it is, because even though it's asymmetrical, it's incredibly fair. And it's very, very hard to just constantly steamroll your opponent because everyone has so many corresponding strengths and weaknesses.
Okay.
Even with the additional decks, it's very, very balanced. So these are very powerful cards, but you can only have one, or very powerful cards, but it means you have to ditch five others to have it.
Got it.
It is oversimplification. But what I love about it, the cards, beautiful artwork on them, and they are so narratively linked to their effect on the game. Basically, as far as the mechanics of the game are concerned, the cards could all be blank, and it's just like, right, I've got five X's on that and two Y's on that.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? If you just saw it in mathematical terms.
Yeah, so
there is story that perfectly matches up to the thing you're trying to do. One of the things the corporation can do is tag the runner. So one of my countermeasures can put a little blip on you that is the equivalent of me having, having bugged your apartment.
Right.
You know, one of the things you can do is you can... There's a thing on the card. I think there's something you can do basically whereby you read what's going on in my servers. And the icon is a jade statue of a cat on a desk in a corporate office.
Okay.
And its eyes are twinkling. And the implication is that you have somehow managed to physically put something in the room that's relaying information back to you.
Okay.
So there is this whole level whereby the story element perfectly syncs up with what the actual things are doing. You know, you can tunnel underneath my deck and see what's going in there. You can sneak into it via a back door. You can bribe someone to come in and help you. And meshed.
You know, it's interesting because we read these books and then you want to play the game that's attached to the book, right? Yeah. And so, like, the Harry Potter Clue game.
Okay.
Because Clue, people love Clue sometimes.
Yep. For anyone listening in the UK, I believe that's Cluedo to us.
Oh,
but
Cluedo.
That's like Colonel Mustard, Professor Plum. Yeah,
that's
okay,
it.
So we call that Cluedo.
Cluedo. Yep. And then, but there's a Harry Potter version of that game.
Okay.
Because in regular Clue or Cluedo is, you can sneak from one corner to the other. There's secret passageways, but they're stationary. They're static. In the Harry Potter version of that game, there's
you
wheels.
You can operate.
Yeah, there's wheels
that
move because remember, Hogwarts moves around.
Yes, of course.
The things change. The staircases move. And so there's moving staircases. It's just an excellent story, using the story from the book and bringing it into the game.
Yes, and what warmth do you then feel towards the designers, the makers of the game? Because you're like, these people care about
they
the stuff
get
I
it.
Care about.
They get it. And it's like the first time that they tried to fix Risk. Because Risk is a game that was designed to give me a headache. And it's sort of like Axis and Allies.
I love Risk. I've played lots of it. I have to say, I played it again recently. It didn't really hold up in the world of Catan and Dead of Winter and all the rest of it. It seemed a little basic.
Do you know what's great is Lord of the Rings Risk. Lord of the Rings Risk is, first of all, the ring is moving towards Mordor.
Okay.
And every turn, somebody re-rolls the bad guy dice, and if you get all boxcars, if you get all sixes, game's over. Turns out Sauron got the ring.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And so there's that added element to it, and then there's Minas Tirith, and there's all these different things that have been worked into it that are – and there's cards that have power points when you're in Weathertop. So they work the game into the – they work the book
That's
into
so
the,
exciting.
The narrative of the
Same
book.
Same with Game of Thrones. Have you played the Game of Thrones
no,
board
no.
game? There's a little card game which is a sort of – you know, it's a branded – it's a –
Yeah.
Fairly generic. No offense. You know, it's not inherently about Game of Thrones. And then there is the board game, which I've only played once. It takes about 5 hours.
Jeez.
Played it with a bunch of Kiwi guys, the fan fiction Kiwi guys who are, wonderful New Zealand comics who are all into nerdy board games.
Oh, cool.
And, fabulous high point of the Edinburgh Festival this year for me was, a manic cycle across the city to grab, Heidi O'Loughlin, a fabulous New Zealand comic, to grab her copy of Dead of Winter so that I could go and introduce my friends to it that I was staying with. And she had to do a show, and it was like, meet you at the corner, get the keys, run up there, get the thing, run back, drop
the
off the
greatest
theater.
Drug drop ever.
Oh, it was so great. I mean, yeah. And completely ethically sound.
Yes, completely. I love it.
So with that group a couple of years ago, we played the Game of Thrones game. They all knew how to play it, which if we hadn't, I mean, Netrunner, me and my brothers pored over the instructions for hours until we eventually caved and watched a 20-minute video because it's so unlike anything that we'd played before. Game of Thrones, if I hadn't been playing it with people who played it before, I'd have had no chance. But that is something within which there are three, I can't even remember, but it's like there's the kind of, the sword victory and the power victory and the kind of the diplomatic victory and all of these things happening at once. It's constantly shifting as to who currently has the strongest army, who has the diplomatic skill, who has the will of the people, who has magic on their side. All of these things are constantly swirling and shifting, and it's just brilliant.
Sometimes, I have a hard time. It's because Andy's super metagamer, right? Like he's, I don't even know if I'm using that word right, but he's a gamer's gamer, right? So he wants to play. By the way, I am talking with Stuart Goldsmith, by the way, and it's at ComComPod and it's comedian.com.
That's correct.
Is your podcast.
Thank you.
And just so everybody knows that, because we are deep down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, no, we absolutely are. We absolutely
board game
are. I have to say, if you're enjoying this kind of, because I know your listeners, they will particularly, if they're going to check out the podcast, I would recommend a recent episode, which I hope will come out next week, which is with Tim Minchin.
Oh, right.
Because he wrote the book and lyrics for Matilda, the musical.
Yeah.
And we talk about that in depth, and as well as his other kind of atheist and various highfalutin business.
Fair enough.
And I really think those ones in particular will appeal to listen. Anyone that's enjoying the board game thing, they're going to love the Minchin.
Excellent. The Minchin episode. So, but it's sometimes the games get too fiddly for me because I like a simple game mechanic sometimes.
Yes.
When there's an overthink and Andy's been working on all these games, but he'll bring games. He does a lot of playtesting. He wanted me to ask you about, something you wrote when I get this, the paperwork, the sort of, what do you want to talk about? So you and your fiance regularly invent games and you'd love to talk with names like, do you want to be an owl or not? What Andy would like to know what that game is.
I'm so glad I would have completely forgotten to talk about these. I totally agree. Right. To start at the beginning, I completely agree that sometimes games are overcomplicated. We talked about Netrunner. My brother and I now cannot play Netrunner with each other because he is at such a level and has such an expanded deck that I don't even understand the moves he's making.
Right.
He's refined it and has become such a sophisticated player. It would be like, you know, it's someone...
You have to grow together.
Yeah, exactly. Well, absolutely.
You got to have
a
buddy,
absolutely
maybe.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of very complicated games if you're playing them with someone else who can appreciate the nuance and the subtlety of the game.
Right. And I can do it sometimes. I don't mean that I don't ever. We have a game called Descent into Hell that is about Dante's Inferno. Wow. And it is We've only played it once.
Okay.
Because it took an hour and a half to set it up.
Yeah, yeah.
And it has 1,000 tiny chits. But I would like to play it again. It was a gift. I want to try it again.
Yeah.
I want to think that I want. I want to be willing to be play. To
absolutely.
Play it.
Anyway, absolutely. So they. There's absolutely a place for those.
Yeah.
Some games, as we know, things like Spyfall that I mentioned and Werewolf. The joy is in the simplicity. You understand the rules in two minutes.
Yeah, Cards Against Humanity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Super easy.
The joy, and then the fun is in finding nuance yourself rather than going, okay, the nuance happens once I've understood disparate 70 sets of rules and you know, changing conditions.
There's different joys in different games.
Absolutely,
is what you're saying.
So,
I love that.
My fiancé and I have a joy for making up games together, which I believe started the crucible of our relationship was a game invented by comedians Mark Watson and Alex Horn in the UK.
Okay.
And this game is called No More Women, which is an unfortunate name because it's absolutely not a misogynist or gender-based game at all. But I'll explain the game very quickly and then I'll talk about the version
we play. About the movie A Boy and His Dog? Anyway, so...
The game is simply, it's a passing the time in a car, traveling sort of a game.
Okay.
I name any famous person, anyone, real, fact, fictional, historical.
But a name someone would know.
A name someone would know. I name that person and I then name a category that they belong to and I say no more of those. So for example, I could say Jackie Cation, no more podcasters.
Oh,
and
all
now
right.
It's your move. You can name any person in the world, but you cannot name a podcaster.
Okay.
And you have to come up with a condition for them. So for example,
Marie Antoinette, no more, crazy people.
No more crazy people. Fine. You could have gone with no more French people. No more. No more historical
monarchies.
Figures. No more. No more wig wearers. It could be anything.
Yeah, yeah.
But you went with no more crazy people. So as the game progresses, we have to remember no more podcasters. No more crazy people. Bum, 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 until it gets very, very hard to think of people.
Right.
Yes. So me. So that's.
But it has to be women.
No. It's just they just picked for the name of it. They could have called it No More French People.
Oh,
they just
right.
picked a one. No more women.
That would have been charming too, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. No More Women is an example of a particularly devastating move because, bang, suddenly half the population, over half the population is gone from the game.
Yeah, yeah.
So me and my partner, when we first met each other and her partner, me and my partner, when we first met each other, her dad was dying.
Okay.
Really slowly and horribly. And
oof.
The beginnings of our relationship were in me wanting to make sure this person that I'd met was all right.
Yeah.
And she went on to deal with that bereavement in the most strong, level-headed, beautiful, emotional way that I've ever seen a person deal with anything.
Wow.
And I'm sure that was a big part of me going, oh, this...
I guess we're in love.
Whoa, yeah, exactly. For me, the icing on the cake was, at that time, the way in which we would flirt with each other and correspond with each other was I'd explain that game to her, her eyes had lit up, and we started playing a version of it over email where we would send one message to each other and then maybe in the next day or 2 days we'd get back.
Okay.
The game very quickly... Well, fairly quickly became when is a person not a person? Because along the way, one of the moves was no more women.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had no more men.
Ooh.
And then we're like, right, what have we got? So, okay, C-3PO, male, but technically not a man.
Right.
So then, fine, no more robots. Okay, God, no more. What about, okay. And so then by weeks down the line, when is a thing not a thing? It was like, okay, so my person would be, our as yet unborn child.
Right.
No more people that exist only hypothetically. Do you know what I mean? So it became, I've got it. I don't think I have it with me, but we have a copy of the whole hundreds
just
and hundreds
the thread?
Of moves. You know, they would be things like Orion. No more constellations. Because he does seem to fit the, and the rules were sort of, you know.
Because it's a proper name.
Because it's a proper name, but he is neither a man nor a woman, nor does he exist hypothetically. He's a constellation.
Yeah.
So. That was the game. And so that really set the foundations for a joyous relationship filled with making up silly little games.
Yep.
So do you want to be an owl or not? That's some quite high level silly games. I'll start with, if we have time, I'll start with a different one that we invented along the way. This is, I'm so proud of her for this. This is one of the most wonderful games ever. It's called Animal Verb.
Okay.
All you have to do is take turns naming an animal that's also a verb. Right?
What?
A verb, a doing word. So for example, dead obvious, badger. To badger someone. So in the infinitive,
that is a nice
to badger
one. That's
is a
nice
verb.
One.
An animal that's a verb, Jackie Cation?
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Come on. Come on.
Ferret.
To ferret, of course. To ferret around, absolutely.
Yep.
Chicken. To chicken out.
Okay.
We sort of became a house rule that you can, anything that requires a, I don't even know the word, a participle, an out after it to I mean,
to horse around?
To horse around.
Okay.
Completely acceptable.
Okay.
There are so many that a game, once you've had a really good game of that, another backup game is animal non-verb, or non-animal verb, rather, because there are so many that it actually gets quite hard. So we played this game, and it goes on forever. And one of the lovely things about this game, as well as being an origination on her part, is that whenever you describe it to people, they always, counting you in this because you are a game player, but you know, any random person, excuse me, any random person will react like this. What? Ugh. I don't get it. What? Oh, no, I can't do it.
Yeah.
There's one. Ooh, 2 seconds later, they are 100% engrossed. We played this during a fabulous comedy show, a 24-hour comedy marathon show. Me and my partner turned up. There was 100 sleepy people in the room who'd been up for hours and hours. We were there for an hour. We played Animal Verb with every single person in the room. Every single person eventually got one, and off the hour, we left. And it was one of the crowning performative moments of our relationship.
That is amazing. So what is, do you want to be an owl or not? Or the other one? Chin decision. The greatest name in the world.
Okay, we'll do chin decision first because it gets more complicated. Mm-hmm. Chin decision is a physical game which I will attempt to describe visually for your listeners. Perhaps we could also vine it or something if you want.
Right.
Basically, I do this to your face. I'll do it to my own face so I can describe. I put my finger underneath your bottom lip, but above your chin.
Yes.
In that little groove there.
Yes.
And you open your mouth and close it at random. And I try and follow it with my finger, right? That's the whole of that game. Chin decision. You're basically trying to completely...
You know when you're in a relationship and you spend a lot of time with somebody, you're like, I'm going to touch your face.
Yeah, 100%. And we said this to our friend Hutch, and he said the final word on chin decision, he said, we tried to explain the game to him, we were all drunk, and he said, it's not really a game, it's more of an activity.
Very much an activity. That is essentially spin the bottle. If you're doing it with strangers, and it's just you and a loved one, if it isn't with strangers. Have you played it with strangers?
Not that I remember, but I'm not saying I haven't.
Have you played it with acquaintances?
At 2 a.m. in a festival, I couldn't swear I hadn't started doing that with a stranger. But
I almost disapprove.
Yeah. Well, as you should. So we've been playing all these games on a particular holiday to Croatia. We invented loads of these games.
And how's Croatia?
Oh, it's great.
It's
really good. Okay. The language is unguessably weird. Their most beautiful beach is called Zlatni Rat.
Zlatni Rat.
Who
doesn't want to go to Zlatni Rat?
Lovely.
Get your towel.
Dubrovnik, and there's a town called Hvar. H-V-A-R. Hvar. Great.
All right.
So we're in Croatia, and we invented the game. Do you want to be an owl or not? The point of this game is, so it's, I don't think it has to be two player. I think the rules of the game are, it's one of those ones like The Game. You're familiar with The Game. You just lost The Game.
Oh, I did.
You're familiar with that?
No.
Sorry, another term, brief tangent. There is this thing, the whole world is in on this.
Okay.
There's a website, youjustlostthegame.com or thegame.com.
Okay.
Basically, the game is, as soon as you learn about the existence of the game, you are now playing the game forever.
Okay.
And the only way you lose the game is when you remember that the game exists. So it's like a little, like a very early meme, almost a pre-internet meme. If you could just write on your friend's, on a post-it on your friend's wall, you just lost the game, and you just made him lose the game because he remembered the game exists. It's ridiculous.
All right.
So in a similar way, do you want to be an owl or not? Is constantly being played by anyone that knows what it is.
Okay.
How to explain this? I need to infer, I imply. I need to imply that you would rather be an owl than a human being. And the way I do that is I suggest things that you like doing. I try and work them into conversation. At any time over the rest of our lives, I might send you an email 2 months from now. Jackie, great to see you the other day. I saw a tiny field mouse the other day, and I just thought that'd be the thing you'd be interested in, and also you like revolving your head 360 degrees. And I say an email. You can't play on an email. It has to be vocal.
Right.
Because your job, in order not to lose a round of do you want to be an owl or not, you have to realize that I've started playing do you want to be an owl or not, and you need to say, I don't want to be an owl, before I get to the end of my sentence.
Oh, now this one I like.
Oh, it's just lovely. So you could send someone
I was thinking about late at night when you are always awake. You're,
I don't want to be an owl. Yeah, exactly.
Nice. Perfect.
But exactly, it's something like that. You know, it sounds like your sort of thing. Pellets field mice.
No,
exactly. No, you've got to be kind to each other. You can't just do pellets field mice.
Right. You have to do two things.
It's unfair. It's got to be two things, and you need to give them a chance. Otherwise, come on.
I just screamed into the microphone. Exactly. Stuart Goldsmith, this is amazing.
I've never spoken about that on any podcast, and I'm so thrilled that the Dork Forest is the place for it.
The Dork Forest is the place when I don't want to be an owl.
It's ridiculous. And I'm fairly sure she is more responsible than I am for coming up with it, we're getting married next year.
Yes.
And I love her so much. It has not
for
been.
For coming up with that game alone.
Oh my God.
That is some numbers.
Just for coming up with that. I know your podcast occasionally touches mine do on mental health. And it has been a rocky road to happiness.
Right.
I'm so happy.
It's a lifesaver.
That's
the kind of game. The thing is whenever, cause you get all, you know, everybody gets in their head too much and you get sad and you get weirded out. And if you can just find anyone to share something with.
Absolutely.
It'll bring you back to sanity.
A large part of the reason many of us became comedians is because to make people laugh fixes them. To make your family laugh dispels awkwardness, makes everyone love each other again. Certainly that's my background.
Very true.
And the idea that you formalize that with a game such that you could... Are you familiar with the Turtle Club?
No.
This is another little infinite game. I think it's based on a Kurt Vonnegut novel. I don't know where I've got that from.
Okay.
If anyone ever says to you, are you in the Turtle Club? You have to, at the top of your voice, and I'll move away from the mic, you have to go, you bet your ass I am! Even if you're at your dad's funeral. You've got to do that because you're in the Turtle Club.
Are you in the Turtle Club?
You bet your ass I am!
That's the whole game.
And something like that. There was an article in the Guardian newspaper in the UK recently about someone, some of your listeners may already be aware of this. There is a group of friends somewhere in America who've been playing the same game of, what would you call it? Tig? Tag?
Just,
you know, tag.
Tag.
They've been playing the same game of tag for over 23 years.
Okay.
They only play it during the month of February. And during the month of February, everyone is fair game and there is the real shame to being it. So there is examples. You look it up on Guardian.com or Guardian.co.uk. Okay. You could get more information about it. I don't know the names.
23
the places.
Years of tag on February.
These
February.
Guys are doing things like one of them drove 800 miles across America to hide in the trunk of his best friend's car so that he could be driven round to their other friend's house. And he'd go, look at my new car. And then he jumped out. He opened the boot and tagged him. Like, you're it. And I think I remember that because I mentioned the dad's funeral thing. I think one of them said that was the most beautiful moment. He was at his dad's funeral. They were looking into the casket and his friend walked up behind him, put his hand on his shoulder and said, you're it.
And he sympathetically.
Absolutely.
You're it,
man. And he was like, that's so wonderful. He said, his late father would have approved.
Would have loved that.
What a way to enrich your life.
It's a damn gift is what that is. It really is. The thing about game design and about game mechanics is that, and Andy has this whole thing where everything's a game. Everything has a game mechanic. And if you watch any interaction with anyone, you know, you're in line at Starbucks, you're at a strip club, I have a bit that I'm working on but the thing is there is a mechanic. You're either playing or you're not playing. And sometimes you don't want to play.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think of it as a game, you can fix it he's going to love all of these games, is what I'm saying, Stuart Goldsmith.
Glad to hear it. I think the gamification of life is absolutely brilliant and essential and exciting. And I think there are certainly challenges in my own life. I hate exercise. I hate it. I think I learned as a kid that exercise and sport made me feel uncomfortable and I'm frightened of it on some level that even as an adult, I don't seem to be able to work out. If I could somehow gamify exercise, I've just invented sport.
That's it.
But if I could find the sport that I wanted to do, if I could make going for a run in the morning a game against myself or a game against someone else or a game with someone else, then I could make myself do it, you know? So maybe I'll do that. That's quite a good idea.
It's a great idea. It gives a perspective on whatever you're doing, which I think is what comedy does for me and what sales does for my father. And so what the games do for Andy is that, and I think games is a kind of a really healthy way to do it. Because if you're in a situation that's weird, jury duty, and you just start looking at the game mechanics of it and you're like, well, Is someone cheating? Is someone, you know, what's happening? And,
that's fascinating.
I'm
sure there was an organization who are interested in gamifying things in a sort of artistic or socially interactive way. I'm sure there's a video I saw online.
Jane, somebody from, what I like to do is just give the first name on a podcast.
That's lovely. That's like an internet challenge. That's a game in itself.
she talks about the social ramifications of games, and she created some amazing games. She created a game, was it the Trail of Tears games? It was a train game where you try to load people into a train most efficiently to get them across. And it was essentially Auschwitz. It was essentially about the Holocaust. And they were historical games. And there was the slave trade. She does a lot of sort of movement games.
Okay, which are like an art artifact.
Yeah, like Ticket to Ride.
Yes,
like
okay.
Ticket to Ride where you have the train. That's that train game where you try to go the longest route. And but she tries to deal with social issues by creating games that recreate. And you're like, oh, I know. It was the slave trade, and she was working with her daughter came back from school, and her daughter was like 5 or 6 years old, and she said, "What are you studying?" She said, she called the slave trade something else, and it was the Great Migration or something like that. She was like, "Well, that it wasn't a migration so much," and so she said, "Well, what was it?" She was like, "Well, let's," and then she made a paper boat.
Okay.
And she had pennies, and she's like, okay, so we're going to sail over to Africa. We're going to put all these pennies in here, and then we're going to sail back to America. And as you go, you run out of food and you run out of water, and okay, you're going to have to do something. Not everybody's going to make it. What are you going to do with some of the pennies? Mm-hmm. Oh, and they were meeples. She had little meeples, there was a dad meeple and a mom meeple and a baby meeple. And she's like, you're going to have to get rid of one of the meeples. She was like, what do you mean? She's like, well, you're going to have to throw the dad overboard. And the kid was like, burst into tears, which is an interesting parenting. But the lesson was amazing.
Or maybe that's how you create activists. Yeah.
Right. That's how you teach people about injustice and about what it really looks like. And it was this game where she learned that families, she was like, okay, so we're going to go to Africa and there's a family there, but you could only take one. So you're just going to take the baby. And you're like, well, you're not going to take the mom. And you're like, nope, can't take the mom. Mm-hmm. And then some people have to be thrown overboard. And like, it sounded devastating.
Yeah, absolutely.
But a great way to teach people about empathy and a great way to teach people about fact. It gives you a perspective. Games always – I never knew that going into this relationship with my husband about games, because I had only played with my siblings and what Andy calls sibling rules, where he's like, I don't want to play with anyone who's playing sibling rules, because they're like, oh, you forgot to do that? You forgot to get $200 when you pass go? Well, then you don't get to do it. He's like,
sure.
We're trying to play a game.
Yeah.
I want to win too.
And interestingly, I do play a lot of the games I play. I play with my brother.
Yeah.
And I have to be careful about the entrenched strata of the status of our relationships. Like
from childhood.
Absolutely. Because I will do things that I consider to be completely normal. And look, if we're going to get the most out of our ability to both engage with this strategically, we have to stick to this thing.
Yeah.
And he will find that extremely exasperating because he just wants to play the game. And I have to, it's years into our relationship, I learned two great things with my brother, two brilliant aspects of our relationship, two things I can do to make an excellent relationship even smoother. And one of them is the sentence, I apologize and respectfully withdraw. Because as a younger brother, to have your older brother, that is not something I ever did as a kid. And there were numerous occasions where I should have said, sorry, that was my fault. And that would have changed the course of his afternoon, you know?
Right.
And the other one is he's a quite introverted person.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is simply to sit with him and say nothing and wait for him to speak. That's almost a game. Like the game is you go for a walk with my brother. And I love him. I've got so much. I see him and I'm so excited to see him. And I love him so much. I want to tell him everything I'm doing in my life.
Yeah.
And that's not how he likes to relate to me or people. So actually the game is be next to someone you love.
Mm-hmm.
Try to say nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Wait for him to come to you. Wait. He will start saying something and we'll have a brilliant conversation about it. And we'll get on really well. And it's taken me years to learn that.
Yeah.
And I'd say this to his face, that that's the kind of the game I'm playing. Because if I don't do that, I will run in and smother him with extroversion because I'm giddy and bouncing up and down. Right. And I can see it turn him off and make him go, I don't want to deal with this.
Come on, man.
Yeah. He feels it's fake, you know, in the way that a clucky mother will kind of, or a young pre-stand-up comedian around the dinner table will try to fill every available space with chat so that we're all getting on, aren't we, guys?
And actually introverts. Yeah. Don't need that. That makes everything worse. It seems fake and you
right,
know,
just overwhelming. And to give someone time to say the sentence that they need to say, because there are people, I'm a freaking chatty Magoo, man. So to let someone finish their own sentence, that is a problem of mine. And to let someone actually, the idea of silence and letting them come to you with the story that they want to tell is a real gift. And that would be one of my older sister.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to point out that I wanted to interrupt even earlier by saying I'm the same and then realized how inception-like that would be. I'm a chatty Magoo. I'm the same. No, I never let people finish it. Me neither. Yeah, well, that's quite wonderful.
I have this other podcast with Lori Kilmartin about stand-up comedy.
Oh, yes.
And she's like, will you let me finish the story? And I'm like, you are correct. You are correct. I am talking and you didn't get to. And so it is a learned, because I don't know her very well. And so we are 37 hours into a friendship, essentially. Yeah. Feel free to listen to the Jackie Laurie show and watch a friendship be born as I learn how to let her finish her goddamn story.
I've suddenly become hyper aware of it, and I'm really noticing all the times where I'd normally go, yeah, I know, yeah, I like that, and I'm just trying not to.
Right, because you think you're being supportive, and sometimes you're not. Anyway, but it is one of my favorite things is my sister, who is quite honestly better than me, and a lot. She's smarter than I am, and she has different skills, and her skills are amazing. And one of them is she loves to cook, and she's really, really good at it. And so when we were in the kitchen, when we were just young, like in our 18, 20 years old, she'd be like, will you do this? And then sometimes she would come and fix how I would do something. And I'm like, okay, you can either do it or you can let me do it. You can tell me exactly how you want it done, and I will try to do it that way, but you can't push me out of the way or say, I'll just do it, because then I'm not helping and I'm not of any use. I can just sit and watch you work. That's something. And we had that conversation of sibling conversation where you're like, oh, I love you and I want to be friends with you, but we're different people. So
it's so interesting to hear you say that. Not only is that true of my sibling relationships, but my relationship with my partner, my relationship with my fiance. We have a baby and we have been living together while she was pregnant. But until that time, we were enduring and enjoying a long distance relationship for 5 years. We were 100 miles apart.
Wow.
We made it happen. We willed it into existence despite the distance. We made it happen, but we are very new to living together. And there is all the pressure of having a squealing team member there.
Right.
Kind of going for it.
Right.
The first time I've said squealing team member, it's very appropriate. Anyone who has a baby.
Yeah. Is that what you named him? Is it a girl?
That's
boy?
What is it? It's a boy.
It's a boy. Oh, that's neat.
He is neat. Yeah. I mean, it's.
How old is he?
8 months. 8 months tomorrow.
Oh my gosh.
And it is without doubt the most wonderful thing. A frequent metaphor that I'm using telling people about parenthood, and this will probably sound, if not abrasive, it will probably sound abrupt to people who don't have children. But I feel I can say this to other parents.
Right.
So I'm addressing the other parents. In the context of how we're talking about games, what I've been saying is, it's incredible, isn't it? When you have a baby, you realize that until you had a baby, you were playing life on safe mode.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I've been saying. You're on safe mode. It's great. I understand that you, the non-parent, I understand that you have problems. You've got rent to pay. There's all stuff happening. That's fine. But you are wearing an invisible suit of armor, which protects all of your emotions and nerve endings in a way that when you have a baby, that suit of armor is stripped away from you. Nothing is safe anymore. The tooth, the nerve is exposed.
Yeah.
Joy is more. Pain is more. Fear is more. Anguish is more. And that will be very annoying to anyone that doesn't have a baby. And I'm sorry, I totally respect your points.
Right.
But I've been saying to everyone, is that funny? That gamification thing has been in my head. I've been saying, oh, it's like I was playing life on safe mode. I'm talking about my own experience. I thought I was previously playing life on safe mode. Free time, resources.
Right.
Again, that's really interesting. I've been using this without thinking about it. I've also described it as parenting is like you spent all of this time setting up the mousetrap game.
Okay.
You know that game, mousetrap, the boot, the thing, the net, the little all this. all that stuff. You've got that, but it's combined. It's an incredibly complex game, your life. So you've also got your armies and your reinforcements and your right. monopoly money. Uh-huh. You've made it all happen. This, it's all ticking over. It all works. It's all going towards the objective to catch the mouse. And right. the baby turns up and tips the whole thing over and you right. go, oh, I've got to start again.
Right, you got to start again because that kid just ruined everything. And yet you love it anyway.
Yes.
And you're just like, I'm in. But you really fucked everything up. And so you have to rebuild. That makes so much sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And all the time I spent before having a baby thinking, I don't know if I want to have a baby because I really like my life and I've got everything set up nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew as soon as I have a baby, particularly as a person in the creative arts, I'm sure this is true in all sorts of ways in other people's lives. As soon as I have a baby, I thought the stuff that's important to me now is not going to be important to me anymore mm-hmm. in the same way. You know, like
it's a shift.
Completely. I'm living the dream life that mm-hmm. I dreamt about in my 20s.
Yep.
39-year-old Stu. Sorry, we're in LA. 33-year-old Stu.
Exactly.
Has that. I all of my wishes have come true. I'm traveling around the world. It's fantastic. I'm doing comedy in all these different cities. I have this yeah. wonderful podcast. I love it. But now the game has changed and the rules are different. And actually yep. the main priority now is spend as much time with the baby as I possibly can. Now I knew that would change.
Yep.
And I liken it to, the Walter White character in Breaking Bad.
Okay.
Who when the genius of that character, have you seen this series?
Yeah.
The genius of that character is like a chess player. He changes the stakes of what's important.
Mm-hmm.
Someone points a gun in his face, you think there's no way he can get out of that. And mm-hmm. by saying one sentence, he changes what's important to the person who is holding the gun.
Oh, interesting.
And, do you know what I mean? So they yeah. always reminded me of that. And because, you know, the writers will tell you, I listened to them in another right. a writing podcast. They said the reason he's a genius is that he can do things in 1 second that it takes. We paint him into a corner and we spend 2 weeks, a room full of writers spends a fortnight going, how can we get him out of it?
Yeah.
And he can make that decision in 1 second.
Right.
But it's about, when you play chess, this is important. This is important. I've endangered your king.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to win. And then you put your queen there and suddenly the whole stakes are changed.
Right.
And that's like parenting. Before, yeah. you know, the stakes are completely different now. So before I was like, I don't want the stakes to change because all this stuff's important to me. All
right.
my potential fame and my right. potential enjoyment, that's all important to me. I don't want that stuff to stop being important to
and
me.
And you knew it
and
was
of course,
coming.
And I knew it was coming. And then that stuff's not important to me so much anymore. You know, I need yeah. a career and stuff. It's all important, but differently. And it's so weird to think, do you see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah,
it's
like I totally get that.
I knew that my opinions on what was important would change, but I still feared it. Why yes. would you fear it? Because it's your opinions.
Right.
You work towards a thing and then the game changes like Flux, the card
yep.
game Flux, the world's least comprehensible card game. You play the child card and suddenly
yes.
the winning conditions are reversed.
Yep.
Suddenly you've got to get rid of all your cards and, you know,
yep.
and it's...
Fair
it's,
enough.
It's wonderful.
That's a perfect way to end it too, because... Stuart Goldsmith, this was a delight.
Thank
you were a delight.
I've enjoyed
and
it enormously.
People should see, they should go to Comedians Comedian. They should get the pod on iTunes. That Tim Minchin one is a good one to start with.
It's a good one. There's a really interesting one. I mean, the Minchin one hasn't gone out yet, so I feel dodgy advertising
oh, right.
that one. There's a recent one with Bill Burr where
right.
I have a really interesting heated debate with Mr. Burr about whether or not privilege exists. And it was a very exciting,
yeah.
challengey kind of a thing because he doesn't believe that privilege is a thing. And I
That's
held my ground.
That's a super privileged place to come from.
Isn't it really?
Yeah. It's all working but out for you, Bill.
It's a really, I'm very proud of that interview. And I think it's a really good example of the sort of thing I do. Plus,
yeah.
your listeners are predominantly American, I'm sure. So it'll be someone they've heard of.
Right. And do you have one with Stuart Lee?
And not yet, but
okay.
I've spoken to him about it and we're going to put something together hopefully in the next few months. I've got episode 200 is in the middle distance and
okay.
I would think that would be an appropriate one.
Stuart, thank you so much for doing the show. Rangers, you all know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
My hat. They're dancing around my hat. My hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?